These are African rhythms. From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, a conversation with Wangui Wa Kamanji, exploring African indigenous knowledge for restoration and resilience. Africa World Now Project is next. Wangui Wa Kamanji, in her article, Women in Kenya, Rebuild Resilience Amidst an Eco-Cultural Crisis, published in February of this year, a few weeks before the current global pandemic takes a crippling hold, writes that, at the global north, it has become more common to declare that indigenous peoples hold the solutions to the climate crisis. Such rhetoric risks being only lip service if solutions do not recognize and resource indigenous-led work to repair damage to indigenous cultures, commitment to an indigenous resurgence, and the full integration of wisdom of these indigenous values in projects that seek solutions. After decades of shame, violent suppression, and devaluation, much indigenous knowledge held by groups like the Taraka in Kenya has been forgotten, hidden, or impaired. Taraka women have often commented that it seemed like everything was going to disappear. Facing this eco-cultural crisis, remembering and restoring indigenous women's knowledge and practices, grounded in a paradigm of respect and collaboration with the earth, emerges as the most salient pathway to recovery and restoration. Everything is going to disappear. I urge you to meditate on this for a moment. And let's be clear, this reflection is a direct response to the centuries of colonialism, imperialism, forms of slavery, racial capitalism that has continuous implications on every corner of this planet, but in particular, the memories of Africa's peoples and the land. The concept, indigenous knowledge or indigenous knowledge systems, are battered around activists in certain academic circles, although not loudly enough. But what is it? What is indigenous? What is indigeneity? In an attempt to demystify and rescue the descriptor from these limited circles, it cannot be lost that the concept and idea of indigenous knowledge has grounding and context. It is important to address this conceptual grounding and its cultural context because it allows us to place Africa and the African world in its origins and firmly map its epistemic development. Professor Gloria Mugwali adds sharp clarity to this notion when she argues that, and I must quote in its totality, throughout Africa, in spite of ongoing colonialization and the continuing effects of globalization, there are people, particularly in rural communities, who still associate their existence to and with the land and with their immediate socio-physical environments and surroundings. Land has been a source of indigenous identity for Africans in that through associations with the land, local cultures, spiritualities, politics, economics, and the relations of society to nature are defined. There are knowledges associated with the land that continue to guide everyday existence. People continue to negotiate identities, cultures, and spiritualities with particular understandings of the place of the human in their environments. These phenomena constitute important dimensions of the knowledge base, and such knowledge also informs everyday existence. African indigeneity must be read as both a process and a form of identity. It is an identity that defines who a people are at a particular point in time, but it is also a recognition that such identities are in a continual process of existence. The lesson here is that a people's indigeneity and indigenous is not simply taken away from them because they encounter others on their homeland or beyond. The Eurocentric constructions of the indigenous as primitive, culture-based, and static is a ploy to privilege European identity and should be distinguished from what the people claim and assert of their own indigeneity and indigenousness. The latter is about the affirmation of self, community, history, culture, tradition, heritage, and ancestry. Eurocentric constructions are about establishing cultures of hierarchies as a way to accord privilege and power. This is how racism worked and continues to work. To deny African peoples of their indigeneity with the rationale that colonialism disrupted their self-defined and collectively actualized existence and their associations with the land and their homeland is itself racist and endorses the misguided and disingenuous insinuations of white supremacist ideology. Being so, we must ask, why is it difficult to acknowledge African indigeneity in contrast to the claim and assertion of others about their own indigenous existence, especially given the global reach of colonialism? And what epistemological claims do we make in such disavowal? It is from here we can identify the contours of a conceptualization of an indigenous knowledge or indigenous systems. Gloria Migwali goes on to assert in Intersections Between Africa's Indigenous Knowledge Systems and History that indigenous knowledge may be defined as the cumulative body of strategies, practices, techniques, tools, intellectual resources, explanations, beliefs, and values accumulated over time in a particular locality, without the interference and impositions of external hegemonic forces. Moreover, indigenous knowledge systems are not confined to the material sphere, but often interconnect with spiritual and non-material realms of existence. So defined, the question of whether the knowledge systems of Africa and Africans can be deemed indigenous becomes more easier to deal with. It is easy to quickly dismiss this question as being unworthy of our consideration, but it is necessary to focus on its misguided premise, given that it comes to surface in academic circles and discourse even today. We must transcend the particular understanding of indigenous informed by very restrictive Eurocentric definitions of indigeneity. The understanding of indigenous and indigeneity cannot simply be constructed within Western or Euro-American hegemonic conceptual schemes and imposed on all groups across time and space. In other words, we must read the indigenous in terms of an existence prior to European colonialization of land and peoples on various continents. The processes of decolonization extend very directly to the knowledge that informs the way one understands the world. Western Europeans consciously and unconsciously understood this as they first attacked the systems of knowledge production and prohibited access to this knowledge in the places they sought to control. The academy was the epicenter of colonial hegemony, indoctrination, and mental colonialization. And therefore, the decolonization process entails a process of reclaiming, rethinking, reconstituting, rewriting, and validating indigenous knowledge, and by implication, Africa's history, holistically. Therefore, it cannot be overstated that the place where decolonization must be in constant struggle are institutions and systems related to knowledge production and its access. Moreover, we must decolonize decolonization itself, the stale categories of thinking that are trapped in a time warp that recycles old language and conventions that work inside unchallenged hierarchies of knowledge, hard boundaries between disciplines and them-us understandings of content that are increasingly tenuous in a world experiencing a geological recasting of historical time must evolve. Today, Africa World Now Project's Tasneem Siddiqui is in conversation with activist thinker Wangugi Wa Kamanji. They explore the contours and practice of indigenous knowledge and ancient technologies as it informs a decolonization that is simultaneously a resistance and restoration. Through research, dance, storytelling, and facilitating diverse public spaces for critical consciousness and transformation, Wangugi Wa Kamanji is retrieving and restoring indigenous African lifeways and practices. She obtained a master's in African studies from University College London and a bachelor's degree in environmental studies and urban studies from Wesleyan College in the United States. She is undertaking independent and guided research projects in several countries in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, and is a trained facilitator in process-oriented psychology, process work. She is currently undertaking nonviolent communication training and a permaculture design certificate course. Wangui's collective, African High, that is spelled H-A-I, was created to research, reconnect to, and reimagine indigenous African knowledge and practices and convene spaces to share what is learned for the regeneration of the continent, to create an African future. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program.
Wangugi, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Tasneem. I am doing well. It's evening here. I'm just getting over a bit of illness, but I'm all right. Yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation.
I am too. Can you tell our audience where you're calling in from today?
At the moment, I am calling in from a town known as Ongaterongai, which is on the outskirts of Nairobi in East Africa.
I'm very excited to have our conversation today because your work takes a holistic approach. And I would really argue that this is the work of decolonization, which we know is an ongoing process, to not only respond to the violences of colonialism, neocolonialism, enslavement and dispossession and control of the continent and her peoples globally, but to also heal and to repossess, to create radical alternatives and life-affirming systems, a remembering of endogenous and indigenous knowledge systems, African ontologies and epistemologies. And regeneration is so central to your work. But before we kind of discuss regeneration, I really wanted to ask you, so what are some of the intellectual, spiritual, and political pathways that brought you to this work?
I love that question. It's like the, how do you come to this, yeah? And it's so important to trace, you know, our lineages. And in a sense, you know, when within African life was within African community practices, you know, you would always begin by libating, yeah, pouring libation, acknowledging all of the people, the forces, the spirits, the guides who have brought you to where you are. So I love a question. Some of the things that have led me, I think, to this path, some of it is history. And developing and growing an understanding of my own history, my own family history, in particular tracing the histories of both sides of my family, including the difficulties of doing that. So on both sides of my family, and actually there's like three sides of my family, and we're a bit of a mix. On all of these sides, and I apologize, my voice. on all of these sides, my family has experienced displacement as a result of colonialism in, you know, the 100 or more years ago. And so retracing those threads has been, and the work of doing that has been some of the things that have informed my life work at this moment, and encountering the difficulty as well as the loss of memory, the sense that people almost do not want to remember, but also the sense with which this memory is not kept alive or transmitted through, for example, school and so on. And so my curiosity, my restlessness, and my questioning has brought me in part to this path, and beginning to uncover those elements of, for example, my lineages that were pastoralists in this context of East Africa, but were displaced several times. My lineage, the side of me that is part of the people who fought for freedom, but were subjected to several rounds of repression from British soldiers, the British administration, including being displaced out of the city and being put into these securitized villages, which were effectively concentration camps, to break the back of the freedom movement. And then on another side, people who were displaced from highlands in order to both grow tea as well as farm wheat during colonial times, and to see what that has wrought, to see the ripple effects of those displacements in the way that family is disintegrated, in the way that family is urbanized, and in particular in the sense of loss of memory. So that is a big factor in like what has brought me to this, and this desire to understand, you know, why is life like this? Why is my family the way it is? And then why is like my society the way it is? why is my neighborhood the way it is? Wanting to understand these things brought me to this work of, as you say, you know, it's holistic, because in doing that work, I ended up coming to, like, you cannot do it only in bits and pieces. So another big factor that has flowed into my work is a connection with the earth and a connection with environment. And this comes to me from my childhood, in particular, where we lived growing up as a child. It was still in this town. I live in my hometown. I was born in this town, and we used to live in a plot of land, and my mom had a garden there. And this garden was, you know, she planted all sorts of vegetables, and, you know, we would get things from there and eat them at home and so on. And I have two distinct memories. One was of watching her plant, and she was planting maize. And, you know, she's very deft, still is, because she still farms, very deft with the machete in her hand. And as she opened up the soil and, you know, put in three seeds, covered up the soil, like quick, like going up and down the garden. And, you know, while doing that, she says to me, well, you know, these are wild fruits that we used to eat a lot while we were tending to the goats when we were younger and so on. And so learning about, you know, how to farm, or what number of seeds to put into the earth, but also, you know, wild fruits, tasting from the earth at such a young age. And then a second memory from that garden was one day, for some reason, I felt called to walk into the garden. I think it was a weekend, and maybe everybody else was inside watching TV or something. And I was intrigued, you know, as for some reason I lay down in the garden on the soil and just felt, you know, that warmth of the soil receiving me. And next to me was a maize plant growing. And I was like, this is fascinating. So I plucked off a piece of the stem of the maize and put it into my mouth, and I was like, this tastes sweet. It's a bit like sugarcane. I guess maize and sugarcane are like related or something. And just that memory of like lying there and having my own, and it's not really quite my own, but like having this earth and plant mediated knowledge, coming into me of like, oh, certain plants are related. Certain plants are, you know, in a scientific, Western scientific sense now, you would say they're like from the same family or group or species, whatever. But that was coming to me in an embodied way. So these kind of embodied knowledges are also some of what has informed my work now. And in particular, the recovery of those embodied knowledges. Because one of the things that I have had to do in the past number of years is to go back and remember, to go back and recover those knowledges that are often not celebrated in the formal state schooling, which is, you know, an inheritance of missionary colonial education in this context. Those knowledges are not celebrated, those knowledges are not uplifted, they're not the things that are considered knowledge. So I have had to go on a journey of recovering, remembering, revalorizing, you know, holding up these pieces from my memory and from my experiences, and saying, actually, this is a jewel, and this is important. So that has flowed into my work now, and all of the, you know, the spirit helpers, the guides that I've had along the way. Again, gardens, where I used to live, where I was writing my master's dissertation in the UK. Interactions with diviners and the access to spirituality, African spirituality, as well as spirituality, indigenous spiritualities from other parts of the world. all of these have helped me on this journey of memory, of coming back.
And there's so many different threads that I want to pick up on, just from, you know, sort of you retelling your story, because, you know, listening to you, I'm also reminded of Alice Walker's Understanding Our Mother's Garden, or In Search of Our Mother's Garden, excuse me, and discussing, you know, the innate agrarian artistry of Africana indigenous women, right? And also in an anti-essentialist way too, but to think about and really reveal this abundant feminine energetic connection to land, right? And as you said, you know, really examining these practices, these relationships that we have with the land that are also, you know, informed by Africana spiritualities, right? And the ways in which those get disseminated and reproduced through the centrality of women and girls in terms of their relationship to nature, relationship to land. So, and I want to talk about that so much more as well, just thinking about how women in this new era of global relationships, you know, access and make use of technology to connect to the land, and how they're expanding these notions and ideas of technology in their practices. Because a lot of times we think about, you know, African spiritualities, indigenous knowledge systems were a science and ethics to living.
I'm going to quote a couple of people in my response, and I like that you asked the question about technology, and I think, you know, there's something really deep there to unpack. You started off with Alice Walker, and I'm going to bring in Robin Wall Kimmerer, who's an indigenous Native American scholar, writer, theorists, all of these things. And in a recent essay that she wrote, she's a scientist, she's a Western trained scientist, in addition to, you know, really digging deep into indigenous knowledges. And I like this way that she talks about technology as there is technology that is high tech, or what the globalized or westernized world will think of as high tech, you know, my smartphone, the laptop. I don't know if electricity is considered high tech anymore, probably not. you know, depending on where you are, yes. So, you know, these forms of high tech, like, ooh, and you can put in also, you know, nefarious forms of high tech within that, surveillance, drone technology, all of these things. And then she talks about, she contrasts that with high tech, which she spells as TEK, traditional ecological knowledge. And so she sets both of those side by side and says, you know, both of these are technology, both of these evidence such high levels of skill, of time, of ability, of capacity, of impact as well. And so, you know, I'll talk about technology in that sense of the ecological knowledges. And even going deeper than that is, you know, the etymology of the word ecology, as well as other words, is around homemaking. Yeah, so the study of the home with ecology, for example, from the Greek oikos. And so the ways in which we make life, the ways in which we make home, the ways in which we live with our fellow earth relations, the ways in which we live with the earth, as well as work with the earth, adjusting certain things, changing certain things, respecting certain things, leaving certain things alone, all of that is actually quite high tech. And so I'll talk about two examples. One of the scholars who's done a lot of this deep investigation and research in the context of East Africa is a woman known as Njoki Wane. She's from the Embu community in Kenya, and at the moment I believe she teaches in Canada. And some of her work, some of her research is to dig precisely into the high tech of Embu women and the ways in which they know how to work with the land. And so some examples in her writing include, you know, a woman will wake up in the morning, walk out of the door and place a palm on the ground. And this is both greeting to the earth, it is also a way of checking the soil conditions as well as the atmospheric conditions to know what the day will hold in terms of will it rain? Is there enough water content in the soil? What is the level of humidity? What is the level of dryness? All of this information that is useful when she needs to figure out whatever it is she's doing in terms of planting or harvesting or threshing or, you know, basket weaving, all of these things. And she has a lot of these examples in her writing. She's like someone I would really recommend for folks to look up. Another, and this one is a community of women that I've come to know more recently in my own research work in Kenya, is a group of women from the Tharaka community, which is in central Kenya. And I was recently interviewing them about how they have been doing the work of reclaiming, remembering, revitalizing their roles as women in community, especially their roles with regard to ceremonies and rituals. And what was so beautiful is that they, when I met with them, like, they began the conversation with seeds. And so seeds are this, especially indigenous seeds, I'm going to specify, indigenous seeds are this repository of years and years and years, but not necessarily just years, but seasons, as well as generations of encoded, embodied memory. And this is embodied in the body of the seed. Indigenous seeds, in the way that they are selected, as well as tended, and then replanted, contain within them the memory of various different ecologies, different microclimates, different variations within the climate, as well as the ability to continue to adapt. And in particular, I was asking them about, you know, how are they confronting both the dual crisis of the ecological crisis as well as the cultural crisis, you know, with the impact of the many violences that this continent has gone through. And they talked to me about their seeds, and they talked to me about how they are reclaiming indigenous seeds. And so these are seeds of millets, especially pearl millet in that region. Pearl millet is a kind of venerated crop. It is, you cannot have ceremony, you cannot have ritual, you cannot have blessings without pearl millet. And pearl millet is an ancient crop that is indigenous to this continent. It's indigenous to Africa. And is known to be very drought resilient, as well as requiring very little water, as well as being very nutritious. And these are some of the crops that had been on their way to being lost, as, you know, modern foods, rice, wheat, Coca-Cola, processed things, as they told me, had, you know, began to become more the status foods, that if you become rich or if you are wanting to portray yourself as getting ahead, then you switch to these foods. Yet these foods are known to not be as nutritious. They're known to contribute to very many lifestyle diseases, which in the context of Kenya now are really high on the rise. Cancers, diabetes, hypertension are on the rise. So the memory of seeds, bringing back these seeds and bringing together with the seeds, because the seeds cannot happen on their own. And this is the lie of kind of global seed companies, as well as, like, you know, the seed hybridization project, which only looks towards how can we produce more in terms of quantity, in terms of calories. It does not inquire about. Thank you.
You are listening to Africa Woke Now Project's Tasneem Siddiqui in conversation with activist thinker Wangugi Wa Kamanji. They explore the contours and practice of indigenous knowledge and ancient technologies as it informs a decolonization that is simultaneously a resistance and restoration. Through research, dance, storytelling, and facilitating diverse public spaces for critical consciousness and transformation, Wangugi Wa Kamanji is retrieving and restoring indigenous African lifeways and practices. She obtained a master's in African studies from University College London and a bachelor's degree in environmental studies and urban studies from Wesleyan College in the United States. She is undertaking independent and guided research projects in several countries in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, and is a trained facilitator in process-oriented psychology, process work. She is currently undertaking nonviolent communication training and a permaculture design certificate course. Wangui's collective, African High, that is spelled H-A-I, was created to research, reconnect to, and reimagine indigenous African knowledge and practices and convene spaces to share what is learned for the regeneration of the continent, to create an African future. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Continue to enjoy the program.
It does not inquire about the quality. It does not inquire about the taste. It does not inquire about the suitability to soil, to climate, all of these things. So the seeds, indigenous seeds, do not function just as a seed. Yeah, it's like the seed plus, it's like you can't have the mobile phone without the applications. You know, you can't run it. It's like not useful. So it's like the seeds, but also the rituals and the ceremonies that almost like activate the seed as well as its role in community, because the seed is a living member of that community. So the rituals during planting times, the rituals during the Indigenous New Year, the opening of the Indigenous New Year, the celebrations and the blessing of the whole community, as well as the ways in which you work that seed, you know, the instruments that you use, the tools that you use. So this whole complexity, this whole package is high tech.
And you're really articulating a whole web of its relationships, right? So this cultivation of care, of community, of collectives, but with an understanding of, and you so beautifully put it in your master's dissertation, which I would love to talk about maintaining the relationships, societies, spirits, and ecologies. And so the seed becomes really a symbol of this whole complex of relationships and interdependence. And then the process in terms of cultivation on all of these different planes that's required for those relationships to maintain themselves and also to be able to be reproduced from each generation to the next. And this is really this theme of regeneration that you speak about in your research on, and the title of your dissertation was African Theory for African Environments, an Ontologically Informed Articulation of Regenerative African Presence and Future. And I'd like you to talk more about this concept of regeneration as it's so central to the work that you're doing, and the ways that you're really thinking about how we use regeneration in terms of governance, sovereignty, right? How we think about regeneration in terms of the generativity of people and ecologies, regeneration in terms of relationships and recentering the relationship with the earth and ancestral spirits, and thinking about regeneration in terms of how we repossess ourselves and our lands and our and our memory, right? How we come to this sort of rememory and this remembering.
Oh, that's awesome. It's also a very big question. No, I love it. I love it. So regeneration. For me, regeneration, in my own definition, my own articulation, of what regeneration is and in a sense has to mean, always in conversation with both it's not only a political project, it's really a life project, yeah? So my articulation of regeneration is always in conversation with the life project that I'm about, that I'm interested in, which is the healing of violence, both past and present, and the renewal of present and futures. I define regeneration as preventing death, or otherwise said as maintaining life, healing dis-ease, and adding life to community. And the three of these working within a context where sovereignty, individual, collective, community is absolutely present. And this then four together leading to regeneration. So breaking each of the aspects down, preventing death for me includes the things that keep relationships alive, prevent the deterioration of relationships, as well as prevent the deterioration of the individuals as well as the groups who are in relationship. And when I say relationships, like as you mentioned in the question, relationships for me is about the ways in which we are in relationship with an alive earth, as well as in relationship with plants, animals, all of our fellow earth relations, as well as with spirits who are unembodied, so ancestors, as well as other spirit guides. For example, within Yoruba cosmology, you will talk of orishas, for example, and those are also an example of unembodied spirits. And so the ensuring that relationship does not deteriorate between and amongst all of these three levels, between and amongst humans and the earth, as well as earth relations and spirits. And preventing death in indigenous and in indigenous African communities took the form of various different things. Most visitors to especially rural parts of Africa always comment on the ways in which people will take time to greet, for example. They will spend 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half an hour asking after the health and well-being of yourself, your each family relation, the goats, the cows, the what, the land, the family, the, you know, every single detail of your life. And then it's reciprocated on both ways. So, you know, for example, greetings is one of these ways in which we prevent death. We prevent the deterioration of relationships. Another way we do this is by designating, for example, fallow times on land. So the way that a number of farming communities have worked with their ecologies, the ecologies within which they were, was to have farms spread out over an area, or otherwise, if they had one farm, to section it off and move from one place to another, move from one section of the farm to another, or move from one farm to another over a period of time. And depending on the community, some had, say, maybe 7-year cycles or 5-year cycles or 3-year cycles, also depending on what you were growing. And after that period, you would leave that land alone so that it could, you know, regain nutrients, so that it wouldn't go all the way completely devoid of nutrients, so that something different would grow on it during that kind of rest period. So this is also a way of preventing the deterioration of soil, as well as the soil microbiota, as well as the soil chemistry, as well as, you know, so and all of these things, you know, I'm saying soil microbiota, soil chemistry, this is really relationships as well. So the microorganisms within the soil, and the ways in which they interact with the elements in the air, in the atmosphere, as well as the soil, as well as the roots to create more soil, to ensure that, you know, the soil has adequate nutrients for plants and all of this. All of those are relationships. So those are just like two examples of how kind of we knew and it was important to prevent death, by which, as I said, prevent the deterioration of relationships. And so I've talked about it kind of within collective, so humans, soil, which is like ecology or earth, but this also applies on the individual level. So you must also be preventing the deterioration of yourself and your relationship with yourself by, for example, resting, by taking part in rituals, that fortify your relationship with yourself, as well as your relationship with, for example, your ancestors in different ways. And then the second part of my understanding, my formulation of regeneration is to heal dis-ease. And I say dis-ease rather than disease, to underline, you know, that dis-ease is the absence of ease, the absence of harmony, or the absence of well-being, the absence of peace even. And we can be diseased in various ways and in various aspects of our lives and our beings. Even, you know, it doesn't only mean in the physical, which when you say disease, then perhaps most people will tend to think only of the physical. And so the ways in which we heal disease, again, on those three different kind of relationship levels, as well as on the individual levels. So for me in particular, the ways in which we enact justice, through restorative ways of enacting justice. A scholar in Kenya shared with me this phrase from his mother. I'm going to say it in Kikuyu. Adomatite. Yes. Now I'm like arranging my tongue. Because I've never actually tried to say this. Adomatiteago. I'm sure my accent is off. But in short, Adomatiteago. Okay, we'll go with that. So it means people are not thrown away, or people are not for throwing away. So the ways in which we practice justice, which is to restore people back to community when they have harmed, when they have done something wrong, that level of enacting justice in which it's not about retribution, it's not in the realm of let's punish you so that you will not repeat this mistake, which is the, you know, unwelcome gift of colonialism, in terms of how we enact justice and in terms of how we feel and practice justice, because it also gets into the feelings that, you know, then, you know, I'm in pursuit of revenge if something wrong has been done to me. Whereas restorative justice, on the other hand, the ways which in the various ways in which communities enact this always include a form of restoring both the person who has been harmed and the person who has done the harm to their humanity and to community. And so this heals the dis-ease that has been created by the wrongdoing, by the harm. And then in other ways, the ways in which we restore ecologies, through, for example, applying manure, through, and I'll give an example because it's beautiful. It shows, you know, rather than just like this abstracted, it is just manure going onto the soil, boom boom, and it's like we don't actually know where the manure came from, or we don't know what the soil is about. In, oof, I believe it is in Mali. Pardon me if I am wrong. The people to whom this ascribes, but I think it's also a relationship that is replicated in other spaces. But I'm going to give this example from Mali, which is that millet farmers, after they have harvested the millet, will welcome pastoral nomads, nomadic pastoralists, mostly Fula herders, onto their farms. And during this time, they will like feed the pastoralists, and then the cattle of the pastoralists will live on the farm. So this is after the millet has been harvested. And so while the cattle are on the farm, they are depositing manure. They're depositing very beautiful, lovely. And so in this way, and in this relationship that has formed this symbiotic relationship between millet farmers and nomadic pastoralists, there's also the relationship between the soil, and the cattle, of course, are eating then the millet stalks that are left on the farm. And so there's this beautiful relationship formed, and it's a cyclical relationship between the millet farmer, the soil, and the cows, the manure, which means the soil has restored nutrients and can grow more millet so that this relationship can continue to thrive, yeah? And then, oh, I have to talk about dance because I'm a dancer. and in particular, then maybe I'll talk about spiritual dances, yeah? And in my own dance practice, I've often found that like vibration is a core kind of indigenous healing technique. And so when dance is happening, and in my context, there is actually no separate word for dance and music, which is actually, it's actually even bigger than that. It's more broad. So the word for dance, for music, for a drum, as well as for a healing practice, is the same, ngoma. And so in a sense, it's like all of these things are inseparable. If you're having a dance, you must have music and you must have the drum. And of course, it is about healing. It's about a healing practice. And one of the places where you can see this most vividly is in the healing dances of San communities, with an asterisk on the word San, which is still a very debated term. But San communities, for example, I don't know where to put the click, but the Juhansi and the Kam communities will perform a dance, and this is their way of healing in community. And so it starts with a fire, and the energy from the fire is integrated within the circle of women who begin to sing and clap, and then passed on when it has accumulated to a high enough capacity, passed on to a circle of men on the outside of that. And, you know, I think both men and women can be healers. But what happens is when that energy, which they call home, has reached a high capacity, then it leads people into trance. And so they do what is known as the trance dance. And within the trance dance, they travel they travel to God, and both take in what is disease from people within their community, and travel to God for the healing of that, and bring that back into that community space. And so all of this happens in a very embodied way, through song, dance, music. And so this is like one of these healing practices that's taking care of the community, and that integrates the people as well as the spiritual community with which they are in relationship.
I'm so glad that you brought up dance and movement, and really made that distinction, especially in your mother tongue or your indigenous language, that there is no distinction between dance and movement and healing, and really returning to ancient Africana principles and indigenous knowledge systems, also understanding the ways that dance can awaken, or and through that process of dance and ritual, awakens your kundalini energy, your Uraeus energy, as the ancient Kemenics would call that, which is your life force energy, right? Your sexual energy, regenerative energy that connects with the collective consciousness, and then the person themselves acts then as like the vessel for healing. They use, or they are able to diagnose and then transmute that healing to the community. And then you see like this energetic exchange between the masculine and the feminine, which is, you know, symbolic of regeneration, whether that happens in the biological force, but it happens in a spiritual and physical spaces.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And for me, personally, some of my healing moments have come through vibration movement, and sometimes it's been with like a sacred plant, and you know, just vibrating like the sacred plant that I was, you know, sitting next to, just making me vibrate. And in those times, it's like I don't actually know what part of me needs to move internally. I don't know, cause, you know, what trauma does, from an understanding of trauma, is that it freezes aspects of you on the inside. And sometimes you don't have the words for where you have been frozen, where you have become frozen. But you know that that needs to kind of melt or kind of shake so that it can become loose. And words alone don't do it. Especially in this context, it's like you need to move. This thing that has become frozen, and I would argue in our context, in this context of Africa, there's a lot socially that has become frozen. In another piece of writing, I talk about, you know, things that have become static, and I write it as static because I think also on the level of governance with like the nation state and borders, that's another form of becoming static. And that, you know, involves and sets in motion a lot of violence for a lot of people, the notion of static borders. So I would say yes, definitely, like movement is a way of restoring that relationship with yourself, with the parts of you that were wounded thanks to trauma. The parts in society that have been wounded by collective trauma and that have become silenced. Sorry, we went into into dance. Oh, as dance always does, takes you into another realm. But I hadn't actually finished talking about regeneration. So long.
No, I mean, and you brought this up too, because you're talking also about regeneration in terms of African sovereignty, and you had mentioned really moving beyond the nation state. And so much of our socio-political imaginations are hamstrung by this idea of the nation state, that this is an entity that has always been and will continue to be, which is not the case at all. And so maybe you can talk about regeneration in terms of, if we think about governance, because you also mentioned indigenous knowledge systems, African indigenous knowledge systems. We have an understanding of heterarchy, of power being diffuse, right? That there are several different bodies in which, you know, we have like really this embedded checks and balances, so that one sort of body of governance or does not dominate another.
I'll weave that in with the kind of the last aspect of regeneration, which is around adding life, and in particular focusing on governance and some of these indigenous African governance systems. I'll give an example of one community. Okay, I think I have remembered it. I think it's among the Alur or Atiak, which is, I believe, a community within what is now South Sudan, but, you know, before South Sudan. But within this community, how the kingship functioned, or how the governing authority functioned, is that when the kingship or the community had grown to a certain size, the king will basically like send out his sons, send out maybe the eldest son to establish another community. And the reason that I choose this and want to tie it into adding life, but also because it's a bit of causes us to flip our thinking a bit, because the traditional, where by traditional I mean like what we have inherited from the understanding of nation states, is that splitting up, which is called secession in terms of the nation state, that splitting up will mean the reduction in power. Within this community, the sending out of the sons to go and establish their own community, which still maintains relationship with this original polity, and like it continues, you know, it continues to, you form that polity that then has gone out, that one will again branch off into another one, you know, the younger sons will again branch off into other polities. This idea of breaking away or going off, leaving the central, so it's a decentralized way of working, that this actually adds power, or I'm looking for a word for this, which is not just simply adding power, but multiplying power, magnifying power, the power of the originating polity. So rather than seeing it as, oh, the power has dissipated because these people have gone out, it's actually looking at it as actually the power has increased. And so this is one of those ways in which I think indigenous forms of governance, especially those coming from this continent, can hold, like hold a lot to teach us about ways we can, because one level is just on the imagination level, we are really, to be honest, locked into the idea of the nation state. The nation state has become naturalized, yet it has a history. It came out of certain desires, a certain moment, certain actors, and none of those actors were African, you know. So why do we hold on to it so strongly on this continent where, you know, there's other functions, or there's other kind of underlying wisdoms and ways of being that are not served by the nation state. And another example of you know, ways in which we can rethink governance from African indigenous principles is a story from northern Kenya, where a hyena killed, do hyenas slaughter? I don't think so. I think they hunt. Or they kill. Yes. I don't think they slaughter. So I want to.
Due to time constraints, you can listen to the entire program on Africa World Nail Project's SoundCloud. Just search Africa World Nail Project.
I cut my teeth on wedding rings in the movies, and I'm not proud of my address. In a torn up town, no postcode envy. Now everybody's like, come on, let's celebrate. Finally, we're getting cake. Every day we hustling, trying to fill a dinner plate. We don't care. The underdog don't.
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist, Moise Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent, Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher and content contributor and production associate, Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of Grayworks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent. Finally, we
cake. Every day we hustling, trying to fill a dinner plate. We don't care. The underdog don't have no fear. So if we sing about gold teeth, Maybachs, diamonds in our timepiece, you should raise a glass, help us free from this poverty so unfair. Give us free from this love.